liberty, and justice for all.
Can you join me for a moment of silence, please? This meeting is being audio recorded and will appear on the district website. We apologize, but it wasn't working to live stream this evening. Sorry about that. We hope to get this remedied. Okay, so let's start off right away with our presentation. We have Attorney Matt Upton here, and I am so glad you were able to come. Thanks for joining us tonight. Mary had spoken about Matt's ability to do presentations to boards regarding different things, and it sounded like something that would benefit us. It would be advantageous for everyone to hear what he has to say. Matt is, just so everybody knows, Matt is the person that we're consulting regarding the cooperative agreement, because with Chris Piles being the SAU attorney, there was a conflict of interest. So he is one of our attorneys, and that's it. It's all you, Matt.
Do you have a clicker?
Can you turn your mic on, Matt?
Oh. Does this work?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My name is Matt Upton, and I've been practicing school law for a little over 30 years. I'm with the law firm of Drummond, Woodson, and McMahon. We represent, in one capacity or another, about two-thirds of the school districts in the state. One of the things we do an awful lot of is training the school boards, training the teachers, training their administrators. We actually offer the Principals Academy every summer, where we actually educate principals, because often the problems that you experience at school districts have their origins, you know, at the administrative level, conducting investigations, to dealing with student discipline, to issues with FERPA, special education, really the whole gamut. So we're really kind of unique in that way. Most of the law firms don't provide these kind of services. Mary contacted me and said she wanted to come up and see if I could do a training on tips that I could give school board members to improve the efficiency of your operations, making a more cohesive body or board, and things you can do to avoid liability. Let's see if I can do this one.
Great.
So one of the most what I'm looking for. Right now, one of the most litigated issues for school boards focuses on the right to know law. The right to know law has undergone a lot of changes over the last 10 years. In fact, recently the Supreme Court issued yet another decision, which now even subjects your legal advice to a balancing test. And what this means is we have a number of people in the public who are using the right to know law to gather information about how districts operate, and in some cases are suing school districts over violations of the right to know law. And one of the issues that comes up consistently in this litigation is the use of sequential electronic communications. It's a big mouthful for what really amounts to emails that just keep getting circulated from one board member to another board member. No doubt you send an email, when you look down through, you see not only your email, but the response from the person before you, response before that, and it creates more or less a transcript as those emails are circulating amongst the board members. Well, once they reach a quorum of the board, you can actually create, unwittingly, a meeting of the board. And if that, and obviously it's not going to be posted, that meeting, and you're not going to be keeping minutes, although the documents themselves really amount to minutes. But you can create an illegal meeting. I'm going to tell you something that's really, really important, and that is you need to be really careful about what you use email for. I've seen more emails being produced and right to know law requests that include embarrassing comments made by school board members. That you just really want to be careful what you use it for. The only thing I use or recommend you use email for is scheduling, notifications, and the delivery of information for school board packets and the like. Beyond that, I think you should do as much of your, have as many of your communications amongst the board members in open meetings, non-public meetings, or non-meetings. What I find, particularly now in the middle of this pandemic, we're using more and more electronic means to communicate. And people are getting very comfortable with the format, but they're also becoming very casual about what they say and do in these emails. And when you get a request for under the right to know law for all of these emails, the stuff that I'm seeing in the emails generally is not producing a lot of liability. But what it is doing is creating embarrassing moments in school members, particularly when they have to complaining about another school board member, or complaining about a parent who's coming before the board a lot. And you just really don't want that. So keep in mind that you can create an illegal meeting through sequential communications. If you are sued, you can be found to find yourself in legal proceedings, which can result in payment of legal fees and costs. And you can also find yourself in a situation where you're not properly storing governmental records. If you've created an illegal meeting, those correspondence really amounts to, at that point, a governmental record. And all governmental records have to be stored at district offices. So you need to be careful about exactly what platforms you're also using to communicate. And one of the things that I'm going to talk to you about is make sure you use your district email. Does everybody have a district email address? You really should never be communicating through your private email address. You really shouldn't. And one of the reasons why is this issue here, if you inadvertently create an educational record, it needs to be stored in district offices. Beyond that, for your own personal security, if you start communicating using your private email address and there's any type of litigation, there could be an effort to obtain your hard drive to see if it contains evidence that would be disclosable in the litigation. So if you really want to keep what's your private life private, I suggest you don't use your private email account. Some of the best practices when dealing with electronic communications, anything that you receive that has any type of substance in the email, do not reply all of all the board members that are listed on the email. That can create an illegal meeting. You know, the union leader rule, I think if you haven't heard it before, you might hear it now. I personally will not put anything in writing I'm not prepared to see on the front page of the union leader. And if you use that standard, you'll probably never have a problem. When in doubt, if you're worried about creating an illegal meeting or generating a public record, or you just need to vent, pick up the telephone. Don't use email for that purpose. Emails do not go away. You can assume that they will be there forever. Let's move on to the next. And by the way, if you have questions as we're going through this, really feel free to ask them. This is another thing that's happening more and more, and it really happens in the context, even in the meeting itself, where I'm finding board members are picking up their cell phones and communicating with other board members in the middle of the meeting. They're sending text messages, emails, can you believe this? I need to get home, I can't listen to this any longer. You know, all types of communications, some of which can actually violate the spirit of right to know law if you are actually lobbying another school board member about a vote. Because in essence, what you're doing is you're using those communications as a substitute for deliberations. And the public is entitled to know what their elected representatives think and why they vote in any particular way. So you need to be really careful that you're not using electronic communications to act as a substitute for deliberations. Some of the takeaway points that you really need to think about.
For you as a board, and it's going to perpetuate potentially
grievances that might otherwise have been drawn during the grievance process. Most importantly, you need to be really careful about getting involved in personnel matters that could result in having you recused if that matter comes to the school board. A classic example is somebody comes over to you and starts talking to you about one of their coworkers, say, manhandling a child in a classroom. And you start trying to dig in and find out more information about what's going on about this employee. And next thing you know, when you finally talk to the superintendent does an investigation. They pull up some tape from the closed circuit camera system, and sure enough, there it is. The employee is manhandling the child. Well, the superintendent comes up with a recommendation to terminate that employee. If you've been involved to the point of where you now have an actual bias, you've now bought yourself a ticket off of the school board that's going to hear that termination. It's really, really important. But there's a really easy way to handle it. If an employee contacts you about an employment issue, just politely refer them to the superintendent. If a member of the public does, politely refer them to the superintendent. But there is something that's kind of important here. So let's go back to my example where you heard somebody talk to you about, I saw this teacher manhandling a child. Now you're going to say to that person, I need you to talk to the superintendent. This is something I can't deal with. You need to talk to the superintendent. Well, what happens if that person doesn't go to the superintendent? Now you've got information that a child may have been manhandled, and it's not gone anywhere. Because you're not going to deal with it, because Matt told me I'm not supposed to deal with personnel matters. But neither is the superintendent, because the superintendent never heard from the employee. So you need to always follow up with the superintendent and say, hey, I had somebody pull me aside who said they saw a student at manhandling. I redirected them to talk to you. Did they talk to you? And if they didn't, this is what I know. So that the superintendent can at least follow up on the complaint and make sure that we're doing something about it and it doesn't fall between the cracks. This is really important that you do that follow-up. Even though you can't deal with it, you need to do the follow-up. There are things that, from time to time, that come up involving the superintendent. And if you get a complaint about the superintendent, which I'm sure you won't, knowing your current superintendent, but if you do, you need to direct them to the school board chair. The school board chair needs to contact legal counsel to talk about what's the best way to deal with it. If, even after you've given these complaints to the superintendent, if you're hearing that there are problems still going on at the building level, and you feel that the superintendent is not adequately addressing it, that's something between the board and the superintendent. But it really doesn't give the board the authority or the right to intervene, because by statute, the only person who can deal with these issues is the superintendent. And actually, for many respects, if anybody's a parent here, it's hard when the teachers reach out to you and say, hey, we've got this problem in our building, because you feel like you're stuck in the middle. And you've got kids in the building, and maybe you have to deal with that teacher on a regular basis. It's so much easier when you can just say, I can't deal with it. This is not my job. This is the superintendent's job, and I want the superintendent to handle it. It's so much easier, and it takes a lot of weight off of your shoulders, because you can't really deal with it. This is one subject that really deals with board dynamics. And I've seen it over and over and over again. And it really creates a level of dysfunction. And I think what ends up happening is often when board members get on the school board, they think it's their job to fix problems that have occurred in the past. And they go about it by gathering their own information and coming to the school board meetings and bringing out their own information about their concerns and what they've developed, what they've discovered, and how other districts deal with things. And right now, one of the big issues is now that the CDC has said people are fully vaccinated, don't have to wear masks, go indoors. You know, there's going to be, you're going to have situations where you're going to talk about what do we do going forward? What are other districts? And rather than going out and doing your own research and investigation into what other districts are doing, you really are better off to ask the superintendent to gather that information for you. The superintendent is has a staff of people, has connections, can talk to the New Hampshire School Administrators Association. You can find these things out much more efficiently than you can with board members. But what it also does is it allows the superintendent to give the same information to everybody all at once. So that everybody has the same information, everybody has it before the meeting, and it doesn't feel like you're sitting there and all of a sudden one of the board members comes in with a big pile of information and just throws it onto the table. Everybody's caught off guard by it and nobody knows what to do with it. This is just simply the best way. Now there is a downside to this, and I want to talk more about that. Now, does you have to be mindful of what you're asking the administration to do? They have, in particular on budget time, they have numerous responsibilities that they have to discharge. And so you need to be able to temper what you're looking for from information, and it's really up to the board to decide what those priorities are going to be. Because to the degree the superintendent is doing research for any one board member, that's time the superintendent doesn't have to spend on other priorities of the board, like budgeting, who knows what else, looking into what other districts are doing for masks, or whatever, you know, other changes that are being brought about by the pandemic, or the lack of the pandemic. So you need to be kind of mindful of what kind of burden is being placed on the superintendent. At some level, and I've seen board members go to this length, that if you want any information from the superintendent, you need to come to the board, request it from the board chair in an open meeting, and then the board can decide what the priority to give that request for information. Most of the time, the superintendent's able to kind of deal with those issues directly with the board member, and it doesn't have to get to the point where the board as a whole is deciding that, but I have seen it where people are, you know, really have a lot of information they want, and that's certainly one of the options if the superintendent feels overwhelmed. But once again, this whole issue about if you're doing an investigation on your own and it has anything to do where you as a board member may have to be sitting in a quasi-judicial manner, which is what happens whenever you're sitting in like a termination hearing, you need to be mindful of you conducting your own investigation and creating actual bias can buy you a ticket off the school board when that matter comes forward. So there's a downside to doing these investigations as well. And really, I've kind of already gone over this. You know, I usually like to say that if it's something that's routine information, something that the BA can generate with just a quick report, something that is not going to take a lot of time, maybe that's just between the superintendent and board members. It's more of the big investigations into what's happening statewide, those kind of things tend to be time-consuming, and you might want to consider whether you want those requests to come to the board so that you can prioritize the activities of the administration. This is something, this is another right-to-know law kind of problem that happens fairly often. And that is, we have a specific reason why we go into non-public session. We have to state the reason we're going into non-public session when we make the motion to go into non-public session. And once we get into non-public session, we start wandering off the topic. And it's something that the school board chair has to really be careful about. Make sure that we stay to the limited purposes for why we're going into non-public session. And once again, I'm going to tell you this over and over again. I think transparency, I think following the law, involving the public in your discussions where the law requires it, it builds public trust. This kind of thing where if it ever is found that you were in a non-public session talking about stuff that went outside of the scope of the motion to go in a non-public session, it's going to erode public trust. And public trust is something that's earned but lost very quickly. And you really need to be careful about it. And you might ask, well, how would they ever know? Well, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about non-public minutes. But if you have detailed non-public minutes, there may be comments in there showing that you went beyond the scope of the motion to go into non-public. And there, again, there are members of the public that are suing districts around the state for right-to-know law violations. I mean, I think you can read the newspaper. I'm not going to name the individuals involved, but there's a lot of litigation over right-to-know law. You need to be really careful. I think it's a good practice when you start after the public's been excused and everybody's kind of settling in, that the board chair restate why we're here. Just to remind everybody what we're here to talk about and the limited purpose of what we're going to be. And the school board chair needs to really listen. Somebody else other than the school board chair should be taking any minutes. But I'm going to tell you in a few minutes, your minutes of non-public sessions should be very brief. And there's a good reason for it. But somebody other than the board chair should be taking minutes, and because the board chair needs to be vigilant to listen to what's being said. If somebody mistakenly goes off topic, the board chair should interject, the conversation should stop, and you should return to the subject that was the reason why we went into non-public session. I'd like to have non-public sessions to be as brief as possible, because it limits the possibility of anybody getting off track or talking about things that were not part of the motion. This has been something that's more of a technical violation, but in some of the lawsuits I was referring to, this is one of the violations the court found. That is, you always have to go into public session before accepting a motion to go into non-public, even if the only reason you're meeting them that night is to have a non-public session. So your agenda should always be a public session, call to order, non-public session agenda. You should never say, well, geez, we're doing a non-public, so we don't need to have a public session. No. This is a subtle difference, but it's one worth noting. A non-meeting is a non-meeting. And since it's a non-meeting, there does not need to be a public meeting preceding a non-meeting. A non-meeting is a meeting where we do legal counsel, where you're discussing legal advice. There's no need to post a meeting, there's no need to open a meeting. You can just schedule a non-meeting. Sealing non-public minutes. Under the right to know law, all minutes of non-public sessions have to be made public within 72 hours of the meeting. There are three basic exceptions that allow you to seal those minutes and not release them. And these are the only three reasons for you to seal the minutes and not release them. And that is that the minutes contain information that would adversely impact the reputation of a person other than a member of the board, would render the proposed action ineffective, or it relates to the district's emergency functions or operations. Those are the only three reasons you can seal minutes. I see this day in, day out almost, board sealing minutes because they think it's a personnel matter. Well, it may be a personnel matter, but it may not always adversely impact the reputation of the person other than the member of the board. But there is a very simple answer to this problem. And another reason why you want to avoid sealing minutes is when you seal minutes, you can only leave those minutes sealed for so long as the reason giving rise to the sealing exists. So it creates this duty for you to go back and review sealed minutes every so often, periodically, to see if the conditions still exist that gave rise to sealing the minutes. And if they don't exist, you have a duty to unseal them. I'm going to tell you, I think it's a bad idea to seal minutes. There are very limited reasons why you can do it, but there's a much easier solution. The right-to-know law does not require that minutes of non-public sessions be verbatim transcribed. I routinely have helped boards draft non-public minutes that do not require sealing. Discuss personnel matter with superintendent. You don't really need to get into what the personnel matter was, who it involved. You don't have to do that. Discuss pending litigation with legal counsel. Discuss superintendent's performance evaluation. All these are appropriate forms of minutes that give the public the information of why you were in there so that they can once again have confidence that you're not in these non-public sessions doing the board's business outside of the summary of the public, but at the same time do not require you to seal those minutes and revisit those minutes all the time. So this is something I really would pay attention to, and it's a very simple solution to the whole sealing problem. And it's also a simple solution to, you know, disclosing that you actually went beyond the scope of the motion. Because if you do very detailed minutes and somebody wanders off and the school board chair doesn't catch it, and it's in those minutes, and they're not, you know, the kind of simple minutes I'm looking at, those people who are suing school districts and school boards can look to those minutes and use them as proof that you didn't stick to the motion. This kind these kind of minutes are really protection from having that happen. This is another one of these board dynamic situations, and it's really easy to have them. And it can happen almost anywhere in any forum. And that is that school board members are engaged in a conversation, maybe they're at an event, and they start talking about their impression on a particular issue of importance. And if the way they are expressing themselves creates the impression that they're acting on behalf of the entire board, if those comments find their way into the public domain, it can create a lot of problems. And these are board dynamic kind of problems, where board members feel that individual members are not adequately representing their views. And, you know, amongst boards, you have a lot of divergent views. People have all kinds of views about subjects. And, you know, it's okay, like, particularly, you know, in the middle of this pandemic, I have board members all the time, they're disagreeing about whether we should do masks, kids should wear masks, you know, whether we should ever be shut down, whether we should always be in person. And if a board member's out there talking in a way that creates the impression that they're talking on behalf of the board, that we should never be out, kids should always be in school, we should never be wearing masks, that might be that board member's opinion, but it may not represent the views of the whole board. And you just need to be very careful. And be mindful of how people are perceiving what you're saying. Keep in mind that each board member only represents one vote. That's really all you have, one vote, and it takes the majority of the board members present for the board to act on anyway. So what are the best practices? If you feel like you're gonna go to an event where you might be asked to speak on an issue, like a classic example is the annual meeting of the New Hampshire School Boards Association. You're going to go there as one of the representatives, and you're going to talk about a resolution that they may be considering. By the way, I'll see you there because I'm the parliamentarian for the New Hampshire School Boards Association. But you might want to say, listen, I'm going to be speaking on behalf of the board, and this is what I intend to say, and get authorized by the board to speak. If you're going to attend a function and you're at a school board meeting, you know you're going to be at a function, tell the board, I'm going to go to the Coalition to Prevent Homelessness, homelessness or impacts of homelessness on student populations. And I may be asked, what is our opinion? Can I speak on behalf of the board? And what does the board want me to say? These are things that help avoid people in the public coming back and potentially confronting other board members about what they believe because they think you were speaking on behalf of the board as a whole. Now, one of the things you can do is, when you speak, if you're pushed into one of these positions and you haven't had a chance to discuss it with the board or you haven't called the board chair and talked about it, you can say, listen, I'll be glad to give you my opinion, but it's just my opinion. I've not been authorized to speak on behalf of the school board. And that avoids the potential of creating hard feelings about what are perceived as representations of what other board members think on these kind of issues. Occasionally you're going to have, there's going to be an issue that's going to be running around the community. Once again, you may get an email from somebody asking, what does the board think about an issue? You know, that's when I think sometimes you just want to get a hold of the board chair and say, hey, I'm being asked to comment on this thing. What should I do? Do you think we should bring this to the school board and talk about it before I respond? That just will help to avoid creating hard feelings about what you say to the stakeholders. Because sometimes some of the things you say early on in the process can have a profound impact on the direction these issues go. And it may be something that the board as a whole really wants to discuss before any comments are made. You will always have an opportunity as an individual person, if you disagree with the overall view of the board, to state your own position. It's just that you want to make that clear when you're doing it. So say the board says they are in favor of requiring masks, even after people are vaccinated and you don't agree with that. Well, the official communication of the board may be, we're going to continue to wear a mask even if people are vaccinated. But you as a board member say, I understand that's the position of the board, but I disagree with it as an individual member and believe that we should be, people are vaccinated, should show proof of vaccination, and then we should be allowed to not wear masks. This is one that's more about efficiency than it is anything else. It's really important for you to understand that your meetings are for the board to do the district's business. That's what they're for. They're not public hearings. Public hearings are entirely different. They have different rules. They have different requirements. And at public hearings, members of the public have an absolute right to speak. So you need to differentiate between public hearings and board meetings. Most boards allow some input from the public, and I think it's, again, important to hear from the public. But there needs to be a limit, because otherwise you're not doing your business. You're just not doing your business. And it creates this huge inefficiencies. So what I say is you really have to strike a balance between doing your business and receiving public input. You might want to consider whether you should limit public comment to matters on the agenda. Or, by exception, allow members of the public to go into other areas. If you are going to limit public comment to matters on the agenda, you need a process by which the public can ask and have topics put on the agenda. Otherwise, you're effectively silencing public comment on particular issues. But you also need to, you can't have your meetings derailed dealing with issues that you're not prepared to deal with. Some of the issues that you've raised would really benefit from having some time for the board member to research the issue before it can be discussed publicly. That's why if the public asks for an issue to be put on the agenda, the board can actually ask the superintendent to maybe research the issue, get some more background information to the board, so that when the matter is discussed publicly, we have all the facts. Otherwise, what ends up happening is they bring a complaint, we all look and say, I don't know what you're talking about. And it just becomes a waste of time. Consent agendas, I am a huge, huge fan of consent agendas. And I can't say that enough. There's so many things that you are required to accept grants, accept gifts, all these things that just take a lot of time, and emotion, and second, and discussion, and the like. Putting everything that's pretty much ministerial on a consent agenda, it doesn't mean you can't talk about them. The board chair should just recognize, is there any items that need to be removed from the consent agenda? Board members say, yeah, I like number 2, number 6, and number 8 to be removed. And then I move the balance. And if there's not anything else that needs to be removed, there's a second, and you approve the balance of the consent agenda, and then we take up the items one by one that have been removed. In a smaller district like this, the majority of the time, you're probably not going to remove much from the consent agenda. It's just one vote, one motion, and all those issues are addressed. Gifts are the only thing where occasionally it's a good idea to recognize the person who's making the gift. So, you know, governmental agencies that are giving you grants and the like, they don't have any emotional attachment to what they're doing, so, you know, those are perfect things to put in consent agendas, but gifts and things like that often deserve some public recognition, so putting them as an agenda item is always something to consider. Occasionally we get into complaints from parents regarding the education their students are receiving. I saw a lot of that during the pandemic. Parents were complaining about the quality of the education that was being delivered online. We dealt with a lot of those issues. But when it comes to students that have been identified as receiving special education, state and federal law really dictates how those students receive an education. And it's really something the school board as a whole can't deal with. It has to be dealt with through the IEP process. And I think taking sides with parents can be a real problem. There can be specific reasons that the board member is unaware of as to why a particular IEP is structured the way it is. And you can find yourself making comments that are contrary to what the administration believes or what the district's responsibilities really are. IEPs are fairly complex, and the disputes are understandable. They happen all the time. But really, if any parent contacts you about concerns over special education, you really need to refer the parent to the superintendent or the director of student support services. Once again, like I told you before, you can't let things fall through the cracks. So even you need to follow up with the superintendent or the director of student support services saying, I had that parent complain to me the other day saying that their child wasn't making meaningful educational progress, wasn't receiving a FAPE. I directed them to come talk to you. Did they contact you? Because if they didn't, it's going to be probably incumbent upon the director of student support services to look into it. But once again, you're not gathering any kind of information. You're not carrying the complaint forward. You're just telling the superintendent or the director of student support services that you've got a complaint. You never want to comment on the complaint or offer any kind of reassurance oh, I think that's terrible. I'm sure we can fix that for you because it's not within your control. That's something that's totally within the control of the IEP team. I would just, once again, there are enough things for people, members of the public, to expect from you as board members. In those areas where you don't have jurisdiction, it's a great relief to just say, I have no jurisdiction over that issue, I can't help it. And focus on the things that you can do to help members of the public. And those, I think, are the 10 top tips. And I got through in 45 minutes.
Yeah, that was fast.
It is.
Thank you very much, Matt.
Does anyone have any questions about any of this?
I have a couple of things. I really appreciate. Thank you. I really appreciate the specifics, your clarity with specific situations, with how the board members should respond to the public. I want to understand and make sure we're all on the same page that a little more vague, if a member of the public brings up a concern, then the public should be informed that they should come to a meeting or email the board chair so that we have it in writing and it is not hearsay, so that we can address exactly what they're trying to get across, as opposed to having a board member speak on their behalf, and it may not come across the way that the person intends it to.
That's a really, really good, really good question. Occasionally, you're going to get a call from somebody who's going to want to remain anonymous. Unfortunately, we really, there's no such thing as an anonymous call. We need to really encourage the people to come forward and put their name to the complaint. And I think you tell them that I really need you to come forward because otherwise, how do we gauge the veracity of the complaint? And if they don't feel comfortable coming forward to you, then you suggest that they come forward to somebody else on the board or the superintendent. But you really want to avoid chasing anonymous complaints. Now, there are some anonymous complaints, particularly that deal with student safety, that if, for whatever reason, they refuse to come forward, you need to contact the superintendent about that. But one of the things that happens is, and I'm not saying that's happening here, but there are dynamics that get created on the board where members use the anonymous complaint to kind of push their own agenda. And it makes the other board members question the veracity of the complaint because there's never a name associated with it. And that's why it's really important that you get people to come forward if you can at all. I hope that answers your question.
May I follow up, Matt, though? I thought if someone had a complaint, they were supposed to go to the superintendent first.
If it's a complaint involving an employee, then it's totally within your jurisdiction, and that complaint has to go to you. But if it's a complaint, say, about, I don't know, some policy that the school board's adopted, that's something the school board could address. But it's always better to have a name to the complaint, because it stops the suspicion about whether this is just a board member kind of pushing their own agenda.
A question? In prior school board meetings years, when a parent came to a school board member concerning their student or something, we were always told to follow the chain of command, go back to the teacher first, principal, and superintendent. This seemed to indicate superintendent first.
That was safety, though, right?
I say the superintendent, I use that term, administration, superintendent, kind of is that, that chief or that arm of the school district. But absolutely, you know, the teacher should deal with the complaints first and the parent, then the principal, then work out to the superintendent. Absolutely. I'm sorry if that was it. But yes.
Another thing you touched base on, I don't know if you want to bring the slide back up, but for the school board meeting agendas, what are the differences with that versus a town meeting agenda? Could you just go over that again for me?
The difference of a school board agenda versus a town agenda?
Right, what's mandatory for there to be on the school board agenda versus the town meeting agenda?
I mean, the rules typically are the same regarding the actual notice to the public. They're often structured a little different. I mean, I typically like to have, if there's going to be received public comment, you get that at the front of the meeting so that you can get that out of the way and the people in the public can go home if that's what they want to do. Mm-hmm. So I like it up front. Typically, most of my districts limit public comment to 3 minutes. Many of them limit it to only issues that are on the agenda. And again, once again, the idea is not to try to silence the public, it's to try and make sure you get your business done.
Mm-hmm.
So reaching out to them and asking them to send emails regarding concerns is perfectly acceptable, and the board chair can take and delegate those where they belong.
I like that idea.
Thanks. With public comment, I got too, having one at the beginning of the meeting. I know that I just noticed that this, in some cases, we've had public comment in two places. We have one in the beginning, but then we have one at the end, because oftentimes, as the meeting goes on, it stirs up conversation and questions that people might want to ask. You know, again, it's, you know, we have in the phrase not to make the same comment again and to keep it limited, you know, that's supposed to be for new public comment, but is that a good practice to have? That way they don't have to wait until the following meeting, or is there like a pro or con to that?
No, I think that's fine. I tend to try to limit it to one duration at the beginning of the meeting, get it over with, and it's more out of respect for the public so that they can move on with their lives and they're not stuck here until 11 o'clock to make their comment. But you can always suspend the rules. The board can always suspend your own rules and say, you know, we've had a really robust conversation today over Condell and Lawson funding. Is anybody in the public who is still here want to make a comment? You can suspend your rules and ask for public comment.
Yeah.
The reason why it was put in as just one this time is because this presentation was pretty extensive, so. Figured earlier in the meeting versus later.
Any other questions?
I guess, I mean, when people bring, I guess, about bringing something to the board chair or to the superintendent, I mean, there are some things that can be dealt with at their level if it's there, like if it's a personnel issue, obviously it doesn't have to come to the full board unless it arises to that level. But if it's, you know, something that's of general concern, you know, maybe, I mean, I guess does it make sense before it's acted on to have that discussion at the board level, you know, that it's placed on the agenda for discussion?
If it's a policy issue, maybe. But also, I think what we're talking about are kind of complaints where they either need to work their way up the chain of command or they're in the superintendent's under the superintendent's jurisdiction. So really having any conversation at the board level would be, would be wrong. But, you know, it seems to also happen at board meetings. You know, you're sitting there asking public comments, somebody stands up and decides that they want to talk about something the principal did last week that they took issue with. And that's where you're going to have to, in that moment, the board chair is going to have to say, I'm going to have to stop you right there. We don't discuss personnel issues. In public session, I need to refer you to the superintendent who can look into your concerns, and we're not going to be further discussion with us tonight. The idea is really to just keep you focused on what, on board responsibilities, and stop you from getting triangulated in areas where you have no jurisdiction and people are just trying to use your position as a school board to bring about whatever it is that they are not achieving potentially with a superintendent. And it's going to make your life a lot easier. Because when you can respond to somebody who's in the building, you're in the building picking up a job, and somebody comes up and says, you got to do something about this. I can't stand this principal. He's holding these meetings, and they're just disorganized, and it's just a huge waste of my time. You got to step in and deal with this. Sorry. That's not something that I can do.
Excellent. Thank you. Heidi, do you have any questions, or Jess, anything? Okay. All right. We appreciate you coming out. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Drive safely. All right. So we have recognitions.
Yes, I have one. And this, I received an email from Mark Pyre, and it is a yearbook award. They were notified that they earned a rare and prestigious yearbook award. The official title of the award is the Jostens National Yearbook Program of Excellence Gold Award. They were one of 127 schools out of over 15,000 schools. So in other words, the top 0.8% to earn this outstanding achievement. So I just want to let you know who was on the yearbook committee. Eli Elk was the editor-in-chief. Abigail Von Dett was the junior editor. Chloe Braun, Stephen Johnson, Eva LaValle, Emily Wilkins, and Michelle Prentice as the assistant advisor. So big kudos for that. That's huge.
Nice job.
Huge award.
That's wonderful. That's awesome. Any correspondence today? Oh. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Just like to give a shout out to the Coach Cousins and the track team. They only had 9 people at the meeting last week, but I think of the 9 kids, they probably all participated in at least 2, maybe 3 races or jumps or contests. They were small.
Wonderful. So you did find out what it was, right?
Yeah.
You did? Okay, good. Okay, so we're ready for correspondence.
Dear members of the Hillsborough-Deering School Board, on behalf of the members of the Hillsborough-Deering Federation of Teachers, I would like to thank you for your thoughtful gift as part of this year's Teacher Appreciation Week. The combined efforts of the school board, SAU, and building administrators were genuinely appreciated during what has been a challenging school year for all. They are small but impactful gestures that speak volumes about the positive and collaborative culture we all seek to promote in our school community.
Can you turn off your mic if you're not speaking?
We appreciate you for continuing to make teacher appreciation a priority, not only during this week, but throughout this and every school year. It was an added benefit to know that the district was once again helping local small businesses in the process with the purchase of gift certificates. Thank you all for service and your work throughout the year and continuing to support our collective mission of providing the best possible educational experience for every student in our community. Sincerely, Alex Luchar, HDFD President. It's a very nice letter. Cameron is unable to attend tonight because of the switch in the board meeting schedule.
Okay. Did he give you any?
No, I don't.
Okay.
But we've got plenty coming up under superintendent's report.
Okay. And I will go on to public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to share an idea or concern with the board. Comments are limited to 5 minutes per person. No additional public, if it is not the practice of the board to immediately respond to comments made. Do I? Is there any public comment? Okay, so we can skip over the response since we have not had any public comment. Superintendent's report.
I just had to get a drink because I'm tongue-tied right now. Okay, sorry.
That's fine.
I'm having trouble speaking. Okay.
So I am going to start with information on the Conval lawsuit, just to make sure everyone is up to date, that Manchester School District, the largest school district in the state, has now joined this. I had hoped to have more information from Conval, so I was trying to check my email. She knew we had a meeting, and there might have been even more that I could have shared, but it does not appear so. So you have Manchester, Claremont, Derry, Ball Mountain, Grantham, Hillsborough, Deering, Massenic, Massoma Valley, Monadnock, Newport, Oyster River, and Winchester are currently the districts that have now all joined together. So there may be more coming, but I thought that was important that you were aware of that.
It made the headlines last night on WMUR as well.
When is the deadline again, Patty? Is it
May 22nd? What is that?
It's like Friday?
Saturday. Okay.
Yes, they have until May 22nd.
Okay.
The next thing that I wanted to bring up was there has been some emails questioning the requirement use of masks and correlating it to a restraint. So I want to clarify, and this is from our commissioner, as a quote, the department's counsel has been in consultation with the AG's office this morning, and he informs me that the AG's office does not regard school mask mandates as running afoul of RSA 126-U. The AG office's position is that schools are permitted under current state law to mandate masks as recommended by DHHS. The other piece that you probably all saw was, the CDC and their, how they're starting to release some of the restrictions that they've been recommending. But then this was this from Edge Week, that even as vaccinated adults stop wearing masks in many settings, schools should maintain recommended COVID-19 layered mitigation strategies, including masks, through at least the remainder of the 2021 school year. And that was the Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
And one that of the was pieces, forwarded though, to all of you.
Okay, so one of the pieces, though, that I've had an opportunity to speak to our administrators about, one is we are a cohort that, looking at NHIAA, and Jim can talk to this as well if need be, that they voted to allow that masks were not mandated when they are playing. However, when they are seated, on the bench, unless you're able to maintain at least 6 feet, that you would have to wear your masks. So that is one of the pieces, the cohort that our school belongs at, they all voted in favor of that. Did I state that correctly?
Yes.
So that's one of the pieces that our cohort is currently working under. A piece that I would like to ask the board to consider is releasing some of the restriction on the outdoors with the students. Each of the building administrators would like to see that masks not be required during outdoor, be it recess, lunch, etc. Unless, of course, the students were, maybe it was a classroom that was outside and they're doing very close experiments, so they're still very close, they're not practicing social distance. then, of course, that would still be considered too close of a contact. But we would like to request the board to consider lightening up for the outside use of masks at this time.
Then they would still need to be 3 feet apart.
Yes, outside. We're talking outside. I don't know if there's anything our district nurse would like to add, if there's anything you want to add from New Hampshire GHHS, or do you feel like I covered that? Sure, why don't you? If you don't mind, I would love to have you read it.
Thank you.
So what I'm reading you is actually the exact verbiage. Hand sanitizers is what she's looking for. So what I'm reading you is right out of the facts that is updated. It's a 22-page document that's updated weekly with the latest and greatest information that they would like us to follow. And as of May 10th, their statement was, the New Hampshire Department of Public Health and Human Services continues to recommend schools and childcare agencies implement face mask use when possible for students, children, visitors, volunteers, and staff, including outdoor and group settings. Face masks are strongly recommended indoors, especially if students are seated within 6 feet of each other. Whether or not face masks are required in schools has always been left to a local school district board policy. Regarding masks outside, CDC guidance on mask wearing. Masks may not be necessary when you're outside by yourself, away from others, or with people who live in your household. Mask mandates and policies regarding outdoor use is left to local school district board of policy. It is recommended that students should wear cloth face coverings in circumstances when physical distancing cannot be maintained. However, when outdoors and able to maintain social distancing, it is possible to take a mask break. So masks would be encouraged if outside distancing cannot occur, such as group or classes, as Ms. Parento said, if you're really together working in a small group, or when players from a team are sitting on a bench. But for generalized play, kids throwing footballs, there's no reason why masks should be required. Thank you.
So when you get to your discussion, I just would like to have that discussed and a vote, because the board did vote when we put together the reentry plan, and the use of masks is part of it. So even though I would like to do what I want to do, I feel that the board probably should vote on this. The next I'd like to ask Dr. Crawford to come up, and boy, how much longer are you going to have to be doing this?
Good evening. So, So, I moved on to 4 pages now. In order to get a bunch of two, I had to shrink the font to something that I didn't appreciate. So, sorry about that. So, looking at the comparative data, so starting with that community transmission piece that we've been looking at, again, we are trending in a very positive direction. I do want to point out that we are still significantly over the 100 cases per 100,000 that puts us into the red zone, but we are moving rapidly toward what I'm hoping will be a report soon that we are in yellow. We will see if that actually happens. So, in the rest of Hillsborough County, we are at 142.9 and a 3% 7-day test positivity rate. In Sullivan County, you're at 197.7 and a 4.4% rate. I don't know if people have seen on the news, they did have a congregate living facility outbreak in Sullivan County, which is part of what the driver is with their numbers. Our community numbers right now are the best that I have been able to report to you since, well, the very beginning. So we currently have a test number that means anywhere from 1 to 4 active cases in the town of Hillsborough. and zero active cases in Erie, Washington, and Windsor. So this is the lowest levels of active virus in our towns that we've seen. But we still are getting, even in that suppressed number, every couple of days we're still seeing some, so there is some activity in the community. The best number on the list for today is the fact that total hospitalizations, again, these are as of Sunday, because we start the meeting before the final posting for Monday's number comes up. As of Sunday, 46 individuals were hospitalized, and that is the lowest number that we have seen since the first week in November. And currently, 42.7% of the total population of New Hampshire is fully vaccinated. Does anybody have any questions about where we are on COVID data? As far as the school impact, we're in the green for that. Compliance is in the yellow. And frankly, I think the best way to describe that would be a little bit with the mask wearing and that type of thing, so more reminders than maybe we needed to have at the beginning. Staffing for all of the HD buildings is currently in the green, and we are fully stocked on what we need for the remainder of the school year for PPE and cleaning supplies.
Any questions?
Yeah, I have a couple questions.
Go ahead.
I'm fully vaccinated, and I'm curious to know how many of our staff members are fully vaccinated at this point.
So, because this is not a vaccination that is required by law, we only have information that people have disclosed and not.
Right, and I figure that. I mean,
we're not keeping an account because it's not something that we can require for personnel records.
And as far as students between 12 and 19, are there being encouraged? By the way, and I don't know if this is appropriate at this time, but if we haven't seen the Facebook stuff that started up today about possible protests tomorrow.
Somebody is got theirs on.
I'm on because I was talking, but.
Can we check to just make sure they're off and not talking?
But I didn't see that. I didn't know if you were aware, Jen, and I'm sure you are.
I will speak to that.
Yes, I believe the superintendent is going to speak to that. But there is a vaccination clinic.
Yes, and I thank our district nurse for organizing it, just as she has organized many things like the flu clinic, brought the dental van here, and so this was brought forth, and right now 85 participants have signed up.
97.
90, and that's, you see, going up. Last I spoke to her, we're at 85, and this is voluntary. There is absolutely no mandate for this to occur. This is just to provide a courtesy for parents and students. If they choose, they certainly can access it. It's a family decision, and just as all the other pieces are. And so, yes, we have seen the Facebook posts, and that's their right to express that, as long as they're not on the school property disrupting school. But that's fantastic. Great.
So in terms of, I mean, if you are, and I know we're vaccinated, how do we know when we're okay to not have masks anymore?
I think you're probably going to see that it will remain throughout the school year. And they did say that the state was going to be coming out with guidance for next school year soon, but we know what soon is.
Last year, soon
was supposed to be June, ended up in July. But we all have to, the school districts all have to write plans for the 21-22 school year. So we're probably, unless they change it, we're going to have to put the mask, but the goal is we're hoping summer we're going to be able to change our plan and all go back to something different.
Because right now, I mean, I saw a music festival happening in Florida where the students were unmasked, they were right next to each other. This was a middle school music festival playing on stage for the first time in a year. And the messages that our kids are getting, that why is it okay here, but it's not okay here? Why is it I see my family just have a reunion, not mine, but like somebody on Facebook, their family from all over the place just got together, unmasked, hugging each other, right together. And yet when I go outside in the playground or I'm at school and my teacher's been vaccinated and everybody in the building is getting vaccinated, and yet we still can't.
But not all are vaccinated, and especially the children are not, and people are still getting it.
So are we going to then assume, what if a teacher chooses not to get the vaccination, that are our students going to be held liable in the fall to keep masked?
Well, for the remainder of the school year, we are following the guidance of DHHS, which is, and as I had just read in the articles that you were sent, and just pretty much stay the course, and they're allowing more of the outside as, you know, saying that let's start loosening it up outside. We only have a couple more weeks left of school, and it is my hope that we're talking something different when we are.
But when you've got the governor also, when you've got all of these businesses opening up, and they're going to other places, and yet it's still in their own school building, they still haven't seen their friends' faces or their teacher's face. It's definitely a whole variety of messages that our kids are getting. So I just wanted to make that clear. That's all I got to say.
This is something that definitely takes time, and I appreciate that we are following protocol and going through the steps, because it also says something to our children if we implement the importance of mask wearing and then all of a sudden, oh, never mind, we're done. So I do think it's really important for us to take these steps. Thank you. Right, since the beginning.
Yeah.
You're saying consistent, even though it's different from their level of consistency.
Okay, next was the appointments, leaves, and resignations. You should have had a new packet that Carol put together. That is the one that I want you to look at, because that has been revised. It has, we over the past couple of days have been able to hire a few more staff members, and it is reflected on these sheets.
I just have one question on this. What is the report card going to be?
Elementary school. Donna, would you like to speak to that?
Can I stay here?
Sure, you can talk now.
So, the report card committee is a group of teachers that we put together in order to look at our current report card. We're looking for consistency across grade levels. We're looking to make a more standard base because of the work that we've done through the CSI process. And looking at standards and unpacking standards, we need to make sure that our assessments and our reporting align with the academic work and the instruction in class. But that's the goal. It's to look at 6-5, 12-5. Specialists are included as well, so that we can have one consistent report for our family.
Next on my list is the speech and language assistant position, and this is a part-time position that I am proposing and looking for approval from the board. We are, and have in previous years, sent staff up to the Washington School District, and I'm talking about related service providers, so speech and language, occupational therapists, and then sort of like we do with the IT and the facilities contract, they are billed for the services that come back into the Hillsborough-Deering School District. And we are in a position of being able to do this year for Washington with our speech and language staff. And through the funding that we would gain back from sending staff up there, and also to make it work, we would like to hire a part-time speech and language assistant position. We will be sending a pathologist one day, an assistant one day up to Washington, but they will be Hillsborough Deering staff members, and again, billed at the rate so that there's no cost at all to Hillsborough Deering. But it's a win for Washington as well. Part of this, these are all critical shortage areas, and for example, they are currently paying $150 an hour for a speech and language pathologist. We are all in the same SAU, and that is my role as a superintendent, to be looking at how do we make things work for all the schools. So I am proposing to do this. Again, I find it a win for both districts, or I would not be doing it. But I can't hire a staff member without the board's approval, because it would, in essence, be coming out of district funds, because even though it's not, the funding would be coming in from Washington to pay for it. Any questions on that position?
So we have one full-time and one part-time?
We currently, in the Hillsborough Deering District, we have three full-time speech and language pathologists and two full-time speech and language assistants. We would be contracting out one of our speech and language pathologists for one day, an assistant for one day to go to the Washington School District. And in return, with the funding that we would be getting for those services, I would like to hire a part-time speech and language assistant for Hillsborough Deering. I can tell you that, and this is at the elementary school level, we're not touching our high school, middle high. They're pretty busy as is. And they are very excited about the possibilities of our department and really what this can bring. And again, it is a win for both districts.
So they won't be going up to Washington all the time as a non-needed basis?
No, they will be going one, the speech and language pathologist will be going one day per week. An assistant will be going one day per week. It also allows for continuity. So as our students, because they funnel from the elementary schools to the middle, we are going to be seeing much more continuity of services, because they're coming from the same staff, the same criteria, and they will be funneling into the middle school.
Okay, so will that help them to sort of be a bridge for as they go into the middle school?
Yes, and I'm already doing this with the OT, but I don't need to hire an OT in order to do that. And again, it's a win for both. It brings the money is back into the district, because I've done it with an OT before I was superintendent. This was going on. The only reason it is coming is because I'm asking to hire a speech and language assistant, because we actually have the money by doing this to bring someone more in. And that is a win. Okay, so I'm moving along. All right, now what I would like to do is I'm going to ask each of our administrators to share and inform us of what is happening at the end of year and going into the summer. So they're just more updating you with the plans that they already have in place. And I am going to start, usually I would like to put you last, Jim, but I am going to start with you first, because I think you have something extra special to share with all.
And we won't save it.
Save it to the end, though. Is this on?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
All right. So, the NHIAA voted unanimously in three different sessions to let us join John Stark and Hopkinton. So, next year we will be called the John Stark Hopkinton HD Hockey Program. So, it's a mouthful, but we're excited about it. They also agreed to keep us in Division III. They recognize numbers are going down in every district, and they know that as we move forward, staying in Division III, the numbers aren't going to be an issue. So there's one more year in the cycle, which is next year. So the uniforms that they have are going to stay the uniforms they have for next year, which will just say John Stark Hopkinton. But they're purchasing brand new uniforms for the season after, with some of our colors in there as well, so that it's similar to the Red Hawks, where we have the green and red, whatever the color combinations will look like. They'll add our colors in, and they'll have the John Stark Hopkinton HD symbols and logos on there. So we're really excited. No cost to the district. It all falls on students and families. Right now, I know we have one student who will be probably a huge help to them going there next year. But I'm anticipating we will probably see two or three more, maybe even more than that, actually try out as the word spread. We had some kids come out of the woodworks that do play hockey, and we might see a few more kids try out as well, so that's pretty exciting. As we close out, well, I'm going to do summer stuff first. We're going to run our traditional summer school program. We will have at least one teacher per content area available. We have posted them, but I've talked to the teachers individually as well, and we do have enough people that are willing to work those summer programs to support our students and make sure that we're not loaded with a lot of repeater courses going into next year. We also have some teachers that have contracted individually with some students as well. Usually those are our courses traditionally that we do not offer in summer school. So we do have a handful of teachers that are contracting with students individually to recover competencies through the summer, whether it's through a project or a meeting during certain times throughout the summer on Zoom. So it looks like we will have plenty of support for the students as we go forward. So that's something we're really excited about. We are probably going to schedule our beginning of next year the same way we did this year. So we're probably not going to run a freshman transition program over the last couple of years for specific reasons. We didn't get the numbers that we were hoping for. Transportation becomes a big part of it. So we're looking to do a lot of our freshman stuff those first few days of school like we did this year. We think that was much more beneficial. So we won't be doing a freshman transition program in the summer separately. And then to end this year, we're only running very few in-person ceremonies. We feel it's necessary to make graduation a priority for seniors. However, the three things we are doing this Thursday night, you should have all received an invite already for our National Honor Society induction. We're doing it outside. It's a very small venue. Our new inductees will be inducted this Thursday night. Prom is being held under the tent. We talked about this a couple months ago. The company we rent the tent from is giving us a huge discount to set the tent up a month early, that'd be great, a week early. Prom will be running as usual. We're going to try to keep it as much to a normal prom as we can. We are expanding the dance floor to about three times the size as it normally would be to allow for enough distance between the students so that they can dance. Because it's outside, they are going to be required to wear their mask while under the tent and socializing and dancing. But if the board votes tonight that outside during venues we wouldn't have that mask on, we will have to take a look at what that would look like. If they leave the tent, they're able to socialize outside, so we might make some adjustments there. Graduation, we are hoping it's as normal as it possibly can be. The tent that we have is bigger than the tent that we've had in the past. We were only allowing four guests per graduate under the tent with other seating outside the tent, so we weren't restricting the graduates to guests, but we were saying to get under the tent because of the situation a month ago leading up to last week. Four was a reasonable option for the size that we needed and the room that we needed. With the new regulations that have come out and with the way the tent is set up, we're going to be able to allow eight guests per graduate under the tent and still have seating outside the tent. If they have 10 people that want to come to graduation, two of them will have to sit outside the tent. And in years past, there's really not a bad seat in the house. Whether you're outside the tent or inside the tent, it's really set up well. Our maintenance guys do a great job making sure that tent is set up so that there's not a bad seat in the house. So that's our hope. And we're praying for great weather for prom, for graduation, and it looks like we're going to have fantastic weather Thursday night for induction. So our fingers crossed.
Jim, how many in the graduating? How many are anticipated to graduate?
87.
87?
Yep.
I'd like to point out that I came up with that 10 prom idea way back a long time ago, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah, it'll be nice if it's actually something that,
that the kids really enjoy. If you get that tent a week early, prom.
And then now, it will cost us just under 10 grand if we do it again. So it's usually not that much money for them to get a venue, but it definitely keeps them in town. And they can do whatever, they can decorate it however they want.
And what's the date of the prom,
Jim? June 5th, Saturday, June 5th.
And graduation is?
Friday, June 11th.
Okay.
We will be, if our live stream equipment can somehow be rebooted and work, we will be live streaming. We're going to be doing a grand march as the couples come into the prom, so we will live stream the grand march, but that's it, we're not live streaming the prom. And then we're hoping to live stream graduation as well. So as long as we can get the equipment to get back to how it was functioning previously, then we're going to live stream those two events. We also will be live streaming our Memorial Day assembly, which will just be with a handful of people in the gym, which will be Friday before Memorial Day. I believe that's the 29th, I believe. And we'll also be live streaming our yearbook reveal, but that will just be internally to the school at some point in the next couple of weeks as well.
What time is the induction Thursday?
6 o'clock.
Great.
Thank you.
Middle school awesome. Mark. Jim, the parade, I'm sorry.
Yes. There'll be more details coming out about that soon. We still have to touch base with Osran and the PD and the fire before we can finalize those.
Hi, evening. As far as transitions, we're working with the elementary. We typically would have a step-up day format, but again, with large crowd concerns, but we really felt it was important to have the fifth graders come up into the building. There are four sections of fifth grade, so we'll be scheduling them to come up as a class so that we can give them a tour of the building. The time works out nice where the sixth grade, their planning is at 1:30, the end of the day. The elementary obviously goes past that, so that gives us a nice opportunity to schedule to have each fifth grade class come up. We've gone down in the past where they've combined into two large groups. We've done a presentation. We'll be presenting to each individual class as far as scheduling that. We'll have a incoming sixth grade parent night Zoom meeting. Trying to figure out how to make that work, but we're running out of nights and time, but to do that, and hoping that, with an open house in the fall, call me the optimist, or we can have people in the building. So with the current sixth and seventh graders, we feel it's really important that they get to know their advisory teacher for the next year. So we're working on that now, so that we'll pick a time and be an activity where the eighth graders, maybe they're like a UA, or I'll do something with the eighth grade, so we can kind of do the domino effect with the sixth and seventh, so they can go up and meet with their advisory teacher for next year. So on the transitions for end of the year, just really proud of the eighth grade staff and how they've been working with the eighth grade students. We've been discussing options, for the end of the year celebration. We talked some options with the eighth graders, but the common theme eighth grader students kept saying is we want to be together as a class. And so that kind of gave us some options, and again, credit to some very creative people on the eighth grade team. So we're having a first ever Cella banquet. And you can kind of see the setup here. I mean, they're used to having lunch together. You know, we're fortunate that we use all the gym and all this space, and so they're used to the concept of eating together. And so we're going to have a banquet. It's historically, the 8th grade celebration is the 17th, or the Thursday before the last day of school, so we'll do that on the 17th. That'll be from 5 to 7. We'll have music playing. Again, we'll have a student playlist. We're working on the menu for the banquet. We're working on different activities to do and just have, you know, fun and whatnot, because that's what they really wanted to do, is to be together as a class. And so to say they're excited is an understatement. So that's fun being part of that. We will host the awards part in the morning, and we will live broadcast that. The awards portion, and then that's automatically recorded for families. And then 5 to 7 is the Sella banquet, and then afterwards they wanted to have a parade. And so we'll be encouraging families to line up in the parking lot, and they're welcome to decorate their vehicles. We'll have some balloons and streamers and things for vehicles as well. And then we want to go down Hillcat, down School Street, and down to a Grimes Field. And that way other family members can be, you know, at Grimes Field as we circle around Grimes Field. So had some interesting requests. One boy wanted to know if he could drive his dirt bike in the parade, and I had to tell him no. And so we have some four-wheeler enthusiasts that didn't like my answer either. But it's fun to be able to plan that with them. So we're looking forward to that on the 17th. In regards to some summer school options, we have, and appreciate Jennifer's work on getting some grants. So I have 3 staff signed up for one-on-one tutoring options. We was talking as a staff, nobody really liked the word summer school, but we thought about different themes, and so we're calling it a science fiction camp. It's obviously going to be math and reading, but around a science fiction theme. And we're looking at the week of August. August 9th. Through the 13th, and that would be for all grades 6 through 8. It would probably be in the afternoon because the extended school year students are here in the morning. And so we thought if we did that in the afternoons, then they would be able to participate in that as well. So again, we're still working on logistics with that. We we're using COVID funds this year and plan on using them next year. We have academic support, which is on every Tuesday and Thursday after school. We've seen a drop in numbers mainly because of transportation. Historically, before that, you know, students could stay for an hour and then take the elementary bus home. And so we're hoping call me the optimist, if they were allowed to do that next year, we'll see. I know a large jump in numbers for that, but that's an area that we're planning on implementing again next year. We will have our RTI block next year. We're going to change it to Win, What's In It For Me. When we were looking at schedules, a number of middle schools had that name, and we like that as a staff, but we'll have that as time. Also, for academics, we've had an advisory committee meeting for several months, and on the social-emotional piece, where we're looking to we're actually going to do an extended advisory period once a week next year for 30 minutes, and specifically at social emotional learning. The sixth grade has been using a program called Second Step that they really like. The sixth grade students like that. It's research based, so they plan on continuing with that next year. 7th and 8th grade, we're going to be doing curriculum writing. They're really excited about developing their own SEL, you know, curriculum for next year. So because again, we feel that that's as important as the academics, the SEL work with the students, and so with the extended advisory once a week, that should be one of the fun activities, and just everybody's really behind that, so that's what we're working on.
Thank you. Any questions?
Great.
Is the science fiction camp, is that going to be, are the incoming sixth graders going to be invited as well?
Yeah, we're not going to turn you away. Okay. Yeah, the sixth and eighth. And this, next year's ninth grade still feels we're calling them ninth graders yet, but if some of them want to participate, yeah, definitely.
That's, yeah, that's
right.
That's
right. Yeah.
And how would our elementary
school
like to come up? Together, all right.
Support as many students as possible.
Currently, we have invited about 125 students through our Title I for our summer programming, and about 60 students have been invited based on their extended school year within their individual education plan. We will also be having an opportunity for incoming kindergartners to participate in what we call Kinder Fun. So once they come to screening, if families are interested, they can sign up for their child to be a Kinder Fun, and we're actually looking at potentially having that invitation come out a little earlier so we can have numbers. And we will host them for 3 weeks as well if families choose to. That will just be a half day. They're very little, some of them are still four, so it's a big day for them to come into the building, but it's a great way for them to get acclimated to the building and to get to know some of the kindergarten teachers. Currently, we have 5 classroom teachers who will be working through Title I, 5 to 6 special educators, and then 3 kindergarten teachers that are all signed up to work for the summer. We potentially have a few more people that are in the wings that we may be able to hire as well. It really is going to depend on the number of students that we get. I predict that we're going to need a lot of staff because I think we're going to have a lot of kids. And then we also have, through our Title I funding, the potential for some one-to-one tutoring that teachers could do with students virtually or in person. And that's going to just depend basically on if we can get staff interested and available to do it, because they're already scheduled for a lot of work this summer. So hopefully we'll have that opportunity as well. That's it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for each of the buildings, with the pieces that they were describing this summer, those are going to be sort of mandated pieces that we will be putting in the 2021 school year plan, as we're trying to, the state has not put out a template, but yet we are on the countdown on having to have this done. So we are trying to figure out, what do you think they want in it? As are all the other districts from our phone call that we had with the state the other day. But so all those pieces, because it will be coming to the board, this plan, and those are pieces that you just heard will be written into the plan. Okay, Mary, you ready with your financials?
I think so.
All right, let's go.
Am I okay here? Can you guys hear her okay?
No.
I think they want to.
Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know if the audio could pick it up too.
Okay, so we're winding down the year, as you know. So come the end of this month, I am having all spending go through our office and meeting by the office at that point. So hopefully we can get our year end done and start the new year. As you can see, we're at $1.7 million roughly. That will come down more. I foresee at least another $200,000 coming down. So, like I said, it isn't done yet. Next month, I will definitely have a much more definite figure. I know there are some lines in here that are still going to be spent, such as in technology. Because, as you know, this year in technology, we bought a lot of stuff through grants. But we still need some other things. But does anybody have any questions on this?
This is the first one, too. There was looks like a negative adjustment on salary on the first line. It just jumped out at me. It's probably nothing huge, but the $3,200.
Which one are you talking about?
The adjustment for salary.
The $8,000.
Oh, the adjustment for $3,200?
Yes.
I have to go back and look at that, because I'm not sure what it is.
Okay. I was just curious, it just stuck out at me because it was a large decrease.
Well, I mean, the 200 is overall, the whole amount is not a lot.
Right, because of the hiring of teachers.
Exactly.
Okay, so right.
She's got the number that we actually had originally in the budget, but then over the summer, the staff changes.
Right.
Okay, so right. It's the reality of signing.
Yes,
okay.
And again, remember, at the beginning of the year, you're budgeting 18 months out, knowing what you have, and then when you come into the year, you don't always, it changes.
Mm-hmm.
So that number, that is a variable number. So anything else? Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mary.
Okay, thank you. All right, so for discussion, let's start with the speech and language assistant position. What are our thoughts on that? I as Superintendent Parento stated, it's a win-win. It seems clear to me that it would be a hardship to Washington to have to hire someone.
Are we confident?
So if we have someone and then we're reimbursed, it saves all around financially for the district.
Are we confident we're going to be able to fill this? Is it going to be filled right away? I know that there's a lack of speech and language paths available, so.
I can't clearly post and then without saying I already have someone for the position,
right.
But I can tell you, I do know that we even have someone from staff who may have that certification.
Okay.
I think it's a win. I think it's a win. I think it's a win-win. I think it's something that it seems like it'll help both schools and the students. And it seems like it might help with some of that continuity, that consistency. So it seems like it's worth investing in that area. And it's gonna help Washington too, so.
Do we know what the cost is going to be?
Well, there won't be a cost at all to Hillsborough Dear.
Oh, right, because
there'll be no cost. In fact, there may be savings, right?
Right.
Yeah, there's no cost to this.
Great. Then let's do it.
I like us being able to collaborate with Washington as we've done in these others. I just think, you know, I think back to times when I've worked, for example, I'll say about. So Conval has many schools, but they only have one district, one board. So they move people around all the time. It's just that we're a cooperative, so you have two different school boards that we're doing. Otherwise, probably you would be seeing much more here happening that might save both districts. I'm starting to try to look at things like that. And the example is the IT and the facility. How, from an SAU perspective, can we have both districts win by doing some of these sharing of pieces?
Could you just explain a little bit more? When you say no cost, I mean, I'm supportive of the position. I see the need. But, you know, like I know that Washington's going to pay for the time that
right.
they're using.
Right.
But are they going to be, I mean, I guess they're still going to be used by us as well. So the time that they're in us on those other days, that's coming out of our budget.
Is that okay? It isn't about that individual position. That position will be hired and we will, Hillsborough Dearing will pay that salary. But there are other positions that will go up also. So this person, and then what was the other one you said? There will be two separate.
Speech and language assistant and a speech path. You're going and you're not paying their salary.
Right, and then, so we're getting reimbursed for them. So it's
right.
not this one individual position, Chris. It's
right.
it's a matter of sort of the team.
Right.
So our reimbursement will cover or more than cover the salary of a new part-time position.
We currently have budgeted.
Right.
Okay,
right.
Okay.
Does that make
part-time.
Sense?
So that helps a little bit more, too. So, I mean, it still changes things a little bit, but what we have there is not going to be a huge increase because we have money there and we're going to be reimbursed.
It's not a CBA position.
Right.
So if it doesn't work out in a year, it doesn't work out.
Because there's no increase.
Okay. I guess I'm still trying to get my head around this, so maybe after our process.
You're getting money back one day from a PAC and one day from an assistant from Washington.
Okay.
It's coming back into
okay.
our budget.
So it's 100% of their time, of the time they're working.
It's their hourly wage, yes,
okay.
definitely. We're not, Hillsborough will not be paying a cent for them to work in Washington.
Okay.
But the savings for Washington is that instead of paying $150 an hour for speech and language, they're going to be paying $86, $87 because I factor in all the benefits
okay.
each.
Mm-hmm.
But when it all washes out, there's still a savings from what is budgeted for our speech and language department.
Okay. Cool, thank you.
Any other discussion on that or questions? Are we all pretty much in favor of that? I just want to get, okay. Now, policy committee, so we've got this, well, yes. You can take this question.
Sure, you want me to do that?
Yep.
So DK, actually, these are the both the second readings. So the first one is, we had voted on the last meeting, was the first reading. DK payments, checks, and manifests. So again, that was a required by law. So there wasn't anything that we even changed that to. It was just stating things a little bit more clearly. And then if anyone, I'll just move on. If anyone has questions, we can ask afterwards. The other one is the school safety, which is EBB, and that's the second reading as well. So again, just, you know, being updated to match the laws and the legal requirements.
Anything on that, you guys? Okay, so our next discussion item is regarding masks. This discussion we need to keep specifically to the requests of what's recommended outside by DHHS and what's been approved by NHIAA. Actually, we don't have other discussions needed. We just need to talk about those recommendations to see what we want to do.
Yeah, so you're saying that we're not talking sports, we're just talking about classroom and inside the classroom and outside. Is that what you mean?
No, the NHIAA is the sports. So talk about what's been recommended with the sports.
Okay.
And if we're comfortable with the teams playing to follow the parameters.
Which is what the cohort that we're in.
Right, our cohort. And then the masks. The outside recommendation by DHHS.
Okay. Gotcha.
We're not changing anything regarding our reentry plan and inside. Correct?
Correct.
Okay, so discussion.
Well, that does change the reentry plan from the things you've just talked about.
Regarding inside, I said.
Oh, yes. Right.
Inside the school.
Yes.
Okay.
It would be up to the student to decide if they wanted to wear a mask or not, and if they're outside of the schools, or would the coach make the decision?
Are you saying
if the student wants to wear a mask while playing, is the coach going to tell them they can't?
Well, who makes the decision, the coach or the
They're going to be told they don't have to wear a mask while playing. So the coach is not going to mandate a student wear it or not wear it. That's up to the student.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's what I asked, student or coach.
Right.
Yeah. So
student, not the coach.
HYAA may change their guidelines this week because of the CDC guidelines for outside. And so now athletes, when they're out playing on the field, infield or outfield, they do not have to wear a mask. But they said right in the posting, when they changed the policy, they said if students or coaches, if they choose to wear a mask, of course parents can.
But we're not involved with
right, I'm just
HYAA,
using that as an example,
so we need to focus on what we're talking about.
I'm just using that as an example of what Paul was asking. So in essence, I think if a student athlete wanted to still wear a mask, they could.
Yeah, we're not
before COVID, we could wear a mask.
Yeah.
If you wanted to. I mean,
right, now we're getting
this big this is a big incident in Pembroke.
Yeah.
I'm in full support of them being able to take their masks off outside, particularly when playing sports, especially as it gets warmer.
Is your speaker on?
Am I not on? Sorry. I think it's really important for kids to be able to take their masks off when it is safe to do so.
I agree 100%. We're seeing now reports of students passing out, and I really think it's it's perfectly fine. I support it as well.
Right, bacteria is growing, it's getting warmer, kids are getting some facial issues with skin.
And they're already anxious anyway in some sports situations, and it's impacting their breathing and their health. Okay. And as it gets warmer, I agree.
All right, so it sounds like we're all.
Are the teachers allowed as well? Just out of curiosity, if I take students outside, right, I'm a teacher and I take my class out and we're all distancing, is the teacher allowed to also take a mask break?
Yes.
I think that's important too.
I agree.
They're struggling as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Especially now, allergy season too. It's like you can't breathe.
So maybe when we actually have our action item for that, we could phrase it such that make the motion such as, teacher, any member of the school.
And so it's the
board,
it's going to be the teacher. I'm just saying the teacher discretion or the building principal discretion in each building as far as when those groups. I mean, because obviously the teachers are with those kids when they're outside. If they're in those small groups, I guess who makes that decision?
Whoever the adult is that's there.
Right, it's just so we have a clear line of, who's deciding who's not.
Well, I think that, if the kids are outside, they can take their masks off at their districts, and then it's up to the teacher. If the teacher chooses not to take their mask off, fine. If they choose to keep their mask off, fine. However, I don't think it would be appropriate to not be consistent across the school. So that Mr. Bober's class goes outside, but they keep their masks on because Mr. Bober won't let them take them off.
Yeah.
But Ms. Morris's class goes outside and they have their masks off. So it needs
to
be
that's something beyond our children. That's something beyond our control, though, Heidi. Because if we, the delegation who determines it's okay to take the mask off, it would be the supervising, the teacher supervising, whoever is supervising the students. And they need to make that decision, and we need to allow them to make that decision based on what their team is doing at the time. So those parameters can't be set by us. We have to just make sure that they're given that permission.
I can see this turning into a real mess, though. I can see this turning into a mess where some kids go home and say, we can't have our masks on outside.
I think if I'm hearing this, it's because you made the comment that if a teacher takes a class, not recess, we're not talking recess. Recess, we're saying kids, teachers do not need their masks on. But Mrs. Jones decides to take her class out because they're going to study something with science and they're going to be in a very close quarters and group. They're the only class out there.
Right.
That is what you're saying. Am I correct, Harla, that then it's up to the teacher
and
what she's doing with their class.
Right. It's up to the supervising.
Yeah.
But in
teacher.
Terms of recess, the kids would be allowed to have their masks off.
Right. And that's all. That's what I was getting at, too. I just want to make sure that it's was consistent.
Yeah,
situations.
I'm totally fine.
But
with
one
that.
Class to another class, it's based on whatever that teacher.
Right.
Yes.
Well, because then you can explain to your child, they were doing lay off.
Yeah. You can be sure that there's always going to be some parents that say, I want my kid to have a mask on.
And that's right. But also, you're not going to guarantee that kid's mask is going to stay off.
Well,
we're not going to police the kid.
Yeah. All right. So, okay, so we're all set with that, I believe. Now, other business. The Hillsborough Deering. The committee for the Hillsborough Deering Cooperative Evaluation or Revisiting, however we phrased it, that meeting is going to happen. The first meeting is tentatively scheduled to happen May 24th at 7 p.m. Zoom. It appears, we've had some conflicts regarding other meetings that people had to attend and making sure that everybody could be present. It appears that Thursday on the 20th, the Deering Select Board has on their agenda to discuss who is able to come forward to be a part of our committee. So that's where we stand on that, and that's really all of the information that we have. We haven't had our first meeting, but we're looking forward to that. Okay, so minutes. May 3rd, 2021 minutes.
I'll make a motion to approve the May 3rd, 2021 minutes.
Yeah, we need to discuss. Go ahead.
On page 3, under number 6 questions, under player number 8, if a school doesn't have a sport, couldn't the student? And then it should say play for another school as long as that school accepts them. Since this wasn't finished.
Oh, okay. Play for another school.
Under H, the superintendent's report, Roman numeral 5, I believe that should be NHIAA is looking to take action.
Not the New Hampshire
Institute of Art. Huh? Not the New Hampshire Institute of Art when it comes to hockey. Okay. Pretty sure. That could be fun. Art hockey.
And one more on page 5.
Where's that?
Page 3.
Oh, I was on page
5.
Okay.
It was just a little bit above where
possible. And I was saying AA too. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And bottom
of
page 5, right above at the bottom of the adjournment. Later move to formally delete JDC in over seconds.
You
want
to delete all of
our? Yeah. So what are we, I had a note on that too. What was it? To formally delete what?
We said it was already.
That's funny. That's funny.
J.
JDC.
Okay, anything else? All right. All those in favor of the minutes as revised for May 3rd, 2021? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstained? 5-0-0. Do we need a non-public? Okay. So we'll go to our action items, appointments, leaves, and resignations.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Any abstained? I have a motion regarding the speech and language assistant position.
So moved.
Do we need to construct the motion?
Right.
I move that we accept the creation of a speech and language assistant position as described
part-time?
Yes, speech part-time.
All right, all those in favor of allowing...
I'll second.
All those in favor of allowing the superintendent to hire a part-time speech and language assistant, can I have an aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstained? Motion 5-0-0. Policies requiring our action. DK, payments, checks, and manifests.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstained? 5-0-0. Motion passes. Now, EBB school safety?
So moved.
Okay.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstained? Motion passes? 5-0-0. Okay, so let's phrase our motion regarding the masks carefully, please. Do I have a motion regarding the masks?
To allow the removal of masks in an outdoor setting when it is appropriate
and safe to do so according to guidelines set forth by
CDC.
Unless they have bad breath.
Outside. Oh, yeah. Can we just say according to the CDC, DHHS guidelines?
I think,
yes.
Yeah, I think that's...
Also, yes.
I'll second.
And, well, wait, and...
We can do that in a second.
Oh, we could just add it to that? Why can't we? Okay.
Sure.
All right, so I'm going to read the motion again. If everybody is okay with it.
Yes.
It was moved to allow for the removal of masks outside according to the recommendations by the CDC, DHHS, and or NHIAA. Students and staff to remove their masks.
Like outside while on school property, like during...
Staff to remove their masks outside following the guidelines of CDC, DHHS, and NHIAA. How's that?
That's a nice one.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Any abstained? Motion passes 5-0-0. And do I have a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All those in favor?
Thank you all.
That was super loud. Aye. Motion passes 5-0-0. We're out of here. Okay. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Harlow. Cool, thank you, Patty. Oh, my book.
Thank you.
How many hours of meetings did we work in? Oh, dear.
Stop that.